train. You fight harder than those other guys, and you win. You can take it. You can make it. You can do this, Luke. You just gotta believe you can. Pop does. Ma does. I do.
Okay, good afternoon. This is Richard Hsu, host of Hsu Untied, and today I have with me a very, very special guest, Laura Hillenbrand, who's the author of a couple of fantastic New York Times bestseller books, including Seabiscuit and Unbroken. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Laura, I read Unbroken. It's obviously a fantastic book. I know it got made into a movie. Let me start by asking you, how did you come up with the idea and how did you find out about that story?
It was actually my first book that led to my second. My first book was on Seabiscuit, who was a 1930s racing champion. And when I was researching Seabiscuit, I was looking at old newspapers from the 30s. And I was looking at an article on Seabiscuit. I happened to flip a page over. And on the other side was an article on this teenage running phenomenon named Louis Zamperini. Hmm. And the war ordeal that he would go through hadn't happened yet, but his story was already so interesting, I jotted down his name. And when I was done with Seabiscuit, I looked him up. It turned out he was still alive. And we had a phone call, and he told me his life story, and I knew that was the book I was going to write.
Wow. So how many hours did you actually interview him for?
You know, I don't know. I didn't count. I'm guessing that I interviewed him about 75 times. Sometimes our conversations were as many as 3 hours long.
Wow.
And there were things also we exchanged through the mail. I mean, it just kind of went on and on. It was 7 years. And he became very close to me. I learned everything about his life. He used to joke. If he wondered what happened to him in the war, he used to call me.
Huh. So you that project took 7 years to write that book?
Yes.
Wow. And he lived to see that book come out, I'm assuming, right? Or
yes, he did. Yeah, he almost lived to see the movie. He saw most of the movie on his deathbed when he was no longer able to speak.
Wow.
But he was able to squeeze Angelina Jolie's hand and look approvingly. He was clearly very happy with it.
Huh. What did he think about the book?
He loved the book. I was scared to death when I sent it to him. You know, I didn't know what he'd think. It's a lot of pressure to write about someone, you know, who could catch you if you make any mistakes. And he called me up and he said, "You really put me through it. This was so real to me. You recreated it so close to the way it really was that I had to keep stopping reading." And just look outside my window and think, okay, I'm here. I'm not there anymore. I'm not back in the war.
Wow.
But he was really happy with it. One of the things he told me the last time I saw him, he gave me a big hug and he said, "I understand now why I lived this long, and it was to see this book written."
Wow. That's enough to give you goosebumps, isn't it?
It left me in tears. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
It's the most beautiful last thing to say to somebody.
Now, did he have, I mean, so he had an incredible memory to remember all those details. I mean, did you find that he actually remembered all that stuff?
His memory was probably the best I've ever come across. And I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, you know,
right.
And there are people who make a million mistakes and there are people who make very few.
Right.
And one of the things that his siblings kept telling me is that Louis's memory is very, very good. And I would do interviews with him and then I would go off to corroborate everything he said. And it was amazing to me. He would remember a race he ran in 1932, and he would remember down to the fifth of a second what his final time was.
Wow.
He would remember things that I would, you know, catch in photographs, the color of his shorts, or, you know, any other little detail. He was really, really good. He rarely made mistakes of memory.
Huh. Now, did you record the interviews, or did you just take notes? What do you have in terms of raw material that you resulted from this?
I always record interviews. I think if you don't do that, you are leaving yourself open to making a lot of errors because you're trying to catch up with someone with what someone is saying. So you're thinking about what they said a few seconds ago and not what they're saying to you right now, and you end up making a mistake. So I have just acres of cassette tapes with Louis interviews on them.
That's amazing. And did you have all that transcribed, or that's not the way you actually work?
I transcribed it all, yeah.
Okay.
That was always part of the process. I would do it immediately. As soon as I was done with the interview. So sometimes it would be a whole day of talking to him and then transcribing everything, which takes forever. But I wanted to make sure I got everything right. And, you know, if I needed to call him back to clarify something, I could do it right away while it was fresh on the page.
Now, did you do these interviews in person or on the phone or both, or how did you do them?
We did them all on the phone. I was in very bad health. I was living in Washington, D.C., and I couldn't travel. He was in Los Angeles. So our whole relationship until the very end was over the phone.
Wow. And you found that that was just as effective, that wasn't a limitation at all?
You know, I actually ended up thinking it was an advantage, because when he would tell me stories about things that happened in 1928 or 1944, I wasn't looking at an elderly man telling me a story. I was seeing in my mind the 17-year-old, you know, or the 26-year-old. And it enabled me to kind of escape the distractions and just see the story as he was telling it. So I think in the end, it was an advantage.
Now, when you first found the story clip, you said when you were doing the research for Seabiscuit, did you know the extent of the ordeal of that story, or did you not know that when you first started interviewing him?
The only thing I learned about him from that story was that he was one of the greatest runners in history while he was still a teenager, one of the greatest milers. This was at a time when people were thinking, this is going to be the man to break the 4-minute mile. And, you know, he'd had a really interesting history as a youth. He had been a real hellraiser and had turned himself around with running. I knew nothing at all about the war.
Oh, wow.
Later on, while working on Seabiscuit, I did find out the rough story of what happened to him in the war. And so when I called him, I could ask him about that. And we talked and talked and talked. He told me the whole story. And it was just amazing to me.
I mean, it's incredible. Were you almost surprised that a book hadn't been written about him?
He had done an autobiography, but yes, I was surprised that nobody had tackled this one. Although it's a very, very big story. It was a huge life, and it was a life with many acts to it. With his juvenile delinquency, his running career, his ordeal in the war, and then his post-war experience of struggling with PTSD.
Now, did you have a hard time kind of shaping this incredible story into a book? Like, tell me a little bit about the difficulties or how difficult it was to do that.
It was difficult to do, yeah. I mean, in part because it was a story with many different acts, as I mentioned.
Right.
And I needed to find a way into the narrative at the beginning that would hook people and let them know what was coming. So that they weren't just starting out a story about a crazy kid in California and not understand what he was going to face later and why what happened to him as a kid became tremendously important to why he survived the war ordeal. So I looked around through the story and tried to find the most telling moment of the later part of his life, and I did a little look at that first, and then went into the main part of the story. But it was difficult to make those choices, and it was difficult to narrow the story. When I first wrote the manuscript, it was 240,000 words, which is absolutely gigantic, and I had to cut it by way more than half. But that's the way I write. I write everything, and then I cut down. So the editing was hard, too.
Did you have a hard time trying to figure out how much time to spend on the various chapters, whether it was his early running days or the, you know, being lost at sea versus the prison war camp versus the... Did you have a hard time trying to balance that out?
Well, you're always interested in the pacing. You don't want to tell too much. You find out so much as a researcher, especially if you spend 7 years on something.
Yeah.
And you have to know what not to tell as well as what to tell, because if you tell too much, you bore people and you lose them.
Right.
So there was always the trying to come up with a synopsis of a series of events so that you told the facts without slowing everything down. And, you know, and then there were times when so much was going on at once that things had to slow down for that reason. So it is difficult to always keep that tension right through a narrative.
Now, how much outside corroboration were you able to do? I mean, obviously, were you able to interview a lot of people or not that much? Give me a sense of how much corroboration you actually did for this.
I was so lucky in terms of finding corroborating things. Louis' siblings were all alive when I – they're all gone now, and Louis is too. But they were all alive and could corroborate things. They had their own clippings and things that they had saved from the time going back to 1928 or so. I had one of his crewmates from his plane. I had a lot of veterans who served with him who knew him well. I had a whole lot of prisoners of war who served with him, including his two best friends in prison camp and the people who knew him after the war. So I was very, very lucky. I also was lucky in that Louis was a pack rat, and he saved absolutely everything of his life. And he had a 63-pound scrapbook that he mailed to me. It was enormous. It was, it was like a car. And he had saved everything in it. I mean, all the little snapshots he took at the 1936 Olympics. And he had stolen Jesse Owens' do not disturb sign off of his door in their dormitory. And that was in there. And the numbers that he wore in races. And he had made a secret diary in prison camp. And he gave me that to look at. He had made a diary during the war that was very detailed and very long. And it ends most dramatically with him saying on May 27, 1943, that he was heading off for a rescue mission, and then there's nothing else. Hmm. And so I was very, very lucky. There was a lot to find, and so I was able to find multiple witnesses, usually for just about every single event of his life. Also, the man who was on the raft with him when he was on a raft for 47 days. Later did a number of interviews, a very lengthy filmed interview and other ones, so that I could corroborate what Louis said about that time as well.
Wow. And so did you send all that 63-pound stuff back to him, or you still have it?
Oh, no. It all went back to him when I was done. yeah, that was quite a thing to get the scrapbook back down the stairs and out of the house.
Yeah,
but yes, it all went back to him.
Huh. Do you feel – you must feel pretty fortunate that you started the book when you did. Obviously, if you'd waited too much longer, you know, he might not have been alive to tell it. I mean, do you ever feel almost like a destiny that you reached him sort of just in time?
It started to feel like things were being handed to me, like it – like someone was dropping breadcrumbs ahead of me so I could follow a path. I just got so fortunate, and the timing was really critical because a lot of the people that became sources for the book died while I was writing it, you know, toward the end or just after I was finished. Most of them did not see the finished book, but they were there to give me their testimony about what had happened. But I couldn't believe how lucky I was. I mean, I found things in odd places in a museum in Canberra and in Oslo, you know, something that prisoners of war had written down and saved and nobody had ever looked at. It was in an archive. And police records from Japan post-war. It's very hard to find official records in Japan from around the wartime because of the firebombings. Almost everything was destroyed. So I felt incredibly lucky.
Well, it sounds like you really had a lot of fun writing this book. What was the hardest thing about it?
The hardest thing, I think, was the emotional attachment I developed to the people I was writing about, both the people that didn't survive and the people that did, and telling what had happened to them, because there are real brutalities that occurred that I tell about in the story. And the men I interviewed, the prisoners of war and the veterans, a lot of them were terribly, terribly traumatized. And they would weep into the phone, and they would, you know, they would be very, very distressed. One man's wife told me it takes him 3 weeks to recover from talking at all about the war. And so I recall doing one interview with a veteran who told me just really frightening stories about what he'd been through, and he was crying. And after the interview, I had to go outside and just kind of walk circles around my lawn to kind of shake it off, because it was it was difficult. You absorb what's going on. And of course, when you're writing the narrative, you're really getting very deeply into it until you're really there with them. But all of them wanted to tell these stories. They wanted this document to be created to testify to what they'd been through. So none of them regretted doing this, but it was a big responsibility to get it right.
Yeah, interesting. Now, obviously the book has been wildly successful. Did you have a sense, I mean, I'm sure you sensed it was going to be a good book, but did you think it was going to be as successful as it was? Or tell me a little bit how, when it came out, the response versus what you thought, you know, about it.
I don't think very much about what the response will be for my books. I actually did this with Seabiscuit very deliberately. Seabiscuit was my first book. And my expectation was it wouldn't do very well because people kept telling me no one's going to read a book about a dead horse. But so, and I decided, since it wasn't up to me how it was going to do commercially or in reviews, that I would not attach myself to that at all. I would attach myself to doing the best possible job I could and then relinquish the book to the world and be happy with that no matter what happened. And it worked with Seabiscuit. It all then was just this really happy surprise that it was well-reviewed and it was successful. And I maintain the same attitude with Unbroken, and I will with everything else I write, because you can't control what happens commercially with a book, but you can control what the book is, and that's what I tried to do.
Now, one of the things I did a little bit of research on your writing style, and I know, and people talked about how you sort of have a different genre of writing nonfiction, which I actually did not understand, but I thought maybe I could ask you, how do you explain your genre or what it is being written on the internet about your style that's sort of new about nonfiction?
I don't know. I don't know if it exactly is new. What I try to do as a writer is spend as much time and effort as I can on research, so I get as much detail as possible, so that I can write a 100% factual book that reads as close as possible to a novel. And it's I frequently am hear people calling the book a novel, and I have to correct them and say, no, this is actually true. I didn't make this up. But I don't know how my book is different from other people's work, but it, from what I strive to do, is illuminate the story with as much detail as possible, to tell it in a way that it becomes as vivid as it possibly can to the reader.
Now, did you know before you wrote or when did you figure out that a movie was going to be made? Was it after the book came out, or was it before? Tell me a little bit about that.
It was after the book came out. I know that they've been trying to make a movie about Louis' life since 1956, when he sold his film rights for a very small amount of money to Universal Studios in I believe it was 56, and they've been working on it. Originally, they wanted Tony Curtis to play him. And that didn't happen, and it just kept falling through. They kept not getting the script right, and people lost interest and that kind of thing. So there were people trying to get it made still, and once I wrote the book and the book was successful, it gave it the momentum for the studio to really take it seriously and want to go with it.
Now, were you involved in much in the movie at all?
I didn't have any kind of veto power or anything like that. Writers really, I don't know if they ever do. But I got very close to Angelina Jolie, who was the director. She was fanatically devoted to getting the story right, to being truthful to Louis's life. And so I talked to her on the phone a lot. We would have these epic conversations, and we would explore not only the facts of the story, but what it meant in a larger sense, why this story was important and why it was applicable to everyone's life and not just the lives of people who were in the war. And her attention to detail was kind of staggering to me. I think it was the first call I got for checking a fact was they wanted to know exactly what the uniforms looked like for all the schools that competed against Louis' school when he was in high school. All of the runners. And I'm thinking, I don't know that. But Angelina wanted it exactly right, and she got it. She found out what the 1930s high school runners' uniforms looked like at all the high schools in the region. And that was how devoted she was to getting it right.
What did you think about the movie?
I really liked the movie. I thought there were tremendous performances in it. I was very impressed with it. It's a terribly difficult story to tell in the framework of the movie, because you've only got 2 hours. It just was such a huge story, and so there was a lot of time spent trying to figure out how to get all the phases of Louis' life into one picture, and I think that was the hardest thing they had to do.
Did you get a chance to see portions of it before it was made, or you only just saw the finished product as well?
I saw there was a little editing left to be done when I first saw it. Okay. So I did see a couple of versions before the final version. I saw a longer version. They were trying to cut it down at that point.
Got it. So when you kind of reflect, so now it's been several years since the book came out, right? When you kind of reflect on it, are you still pretty pleased with it? Or do you kind of feel like you wish it had done something differently? How do you kind of look back on it now?
I'm happy with it. I mean, I haven't looked at it in quite a long time. You know, I don't go back and reread my books, you know, years later, although I will at some point, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, when I have gone through passages again, you know, when promoting the book or in circumstances like that, I've been happy with what I did. I was happiest knowing that Louis and the other men that I wrote about all felt that I got the story right. Mm-hmm. And that was most important to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, Louis said, "You brought my friends to life again." And he'd cried over that. He'd missed his friends again, and he hadn't thought about them in a while. And that, you know, I'm sorry he was crying, but I'm also happy that I could resurrect them in a way that was real to him. He was the most important part of the audience.
To that extent, was the book more rewarding or fulfilling than the Seabiscuit book, or what would you say to that?
Seabiscuit was very rewarding too. Unbroken, though, is about something a lot bigger. It is about not just what happened in the war, the profound sacrifices that these people made, but also in a much broader sense, it is about how people overcome the impossible, how people can find fortitude within themselves to overcome things that you would think they couldn't possibly do. And also, it's about the damage that trauma leaves in us emotionally and how it's possible to find forgiveness, which is ultimately what this book is about. And that was what I think resonated more with people than anything else. Everybody needs to find forgiveness for something that's been done to them in their lives. And so they could look at this book, and none of them was going to end up on a raft for 47 days being attacked by sharks and being shot at. None of them was going to be a POW, but everybody's got things they have to overcome. And they look at Louis and they found strength in him.
Was there anything unusual or interesting in terms of like the kinds of response you got or from whom the responses, obviously this book was widely, widely read, that you weren't expecting or can share?
Let's see. I don't know if anything was really surprising. What was very moving to me was the volume of letters and emails and messages on my guest book that I got from the family members of veterans. Over and over again, people would write and say things like, "I never understood why my father couldn't stop drinking," or "I never understood why my dad never really could connect to me." And you know, these were children of veterans, and they had not really grasped what it was that their relative had gone through. And Louis's experience enabled them to have a taste of that. And they found ways to come to peace with things that were very painful, because whole families suffer when people have PTSD. You know, it's not just the problem of the person who endured the trauma. And that was maybe the most gratifying thing for me. People talking about how I hated my father my whole life for drinking, and now I understand why he did. And I'm so sad for him, and I love him, and I forgive him.
So now that you've done this incredible story and, you know, about this thing, does that inspire you to do sort of something, has that inspired you to do something else in a similar vein, or now will you do something that's just completely different in a completely area now for your, obviously your next book, which I'm sure you're working on?
I never want to corral myself in any one place. I mean, my second book was such a big jump from my first in terms of just totally different subject matter, similar era, but different subject matter. And I always want to explore. I do have something that I'm working on now that is not related in any way to World War II and this sort of thing. So it will be something new. The fun part of what I do is that I get the privilege of being a layman at something, and the best people in the world at some subject will talk to me and will teach me all about it, and then I get to really learn it, and that's such a privilege. It's so much fun. It's like being in the best school in the world your whole life.
Obviously you're a fantastic writer. When did you kind of figure out that you had this talent or was good at this? I mean, when did you figure that out?
I don't know if I felt I had talent, but I had an inclination to write always. I don't remember when I started In school, I used to blow off my homework so I could write short stories. Mm-hmm. And I did a whole lot of that. I had them stacked one on another in one drawer in my desk. And it was just something I really wanted to do. And no one had ever really told me I was any good at it until I got an internship in high school at a political organization. And they asked me to start writing their newsletter. And the secretary there said, "This is what you should do with your life." And I thought, oh, okay, you know, that's good because it's what I love to do. And, you know, I got the same feedback from professors at college. And so it was what I wanted. It's what feels right to me. I feel like a fish swimming when I'm writing it just, and when I'm researching, it just feels like exactly what my mind was built to do.
Did you feel like you almost related somewhat personally to the Unbroken story? I know you overcame a pretty serious illness yourself. Did some of that kind of resonate with you as your personal triumph as well? Or what would you say to that?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think we all have personal things when we write, authors, I mean, when we write things, we do have personal things that the story will resonate with us for a certain reason. And I was very, very severely ill for a long time with chronic fatigue syndrome. I was bedridden for a number of years. I didn't get down my staircase for years at a time because I was simply too weak. I couldn't turn over in bed sometimes. And I knew something about confinement, and I knew something about losing the world. And that's not to compare my position with that of a prisoner of war.
Right.
But I knew something about suffering very, very acutely, and of trying to get through the next 10 minutes, not just the next day, but trying to find a reason to keep going. And so when I learned about Louis out on the raft, you know, dwindling down to 60-something pounds and having sharks attack him and having one relentless thing happen after another, I could understand the basic emotion behind it, even though I couldn't understand the experience of it. Mm-hmm. And similarly with his time in prison camp, I felt there were aspects of that I could really relate to in terms of the suffering he went through. And he also felt that because I had gone through this, that I was the person to write this book, because he felt that I did understand it in a way that other people didn't. And we bonded over that. I didn't actually tell him I had this illness for quite a while I was working on it. But I wrote a story for The New Yorker called A Sudden Illness back in 2003, and he got hold of it and read it, and he mailed me his Purple Heart. And he wrote on the little placket that goes with it that I deserve this more than he did.
Wow.
And it blew me away. And I called him up and said, "I can't possibly accept this." And he said, "Please do. I really want you to." So it's one of my most treasured possessions. But it was something that bonded the two of us, and it made his story understandable to me.
Do you ever think, I mean, that's such an incredible story. It sounds like it's such an incredible connection you had with him, and you did so much to inspire him and all that. Do you ever think, like, now that you've done that, like, you'll never be able to have an experience like that in your own life? That was so, I mean, it just sounds so incredible to have that experience. Do you ever worry, like, or think that, you know, you'll never be able to repeat something as great as this relationship you had with Louis Zaffaroni?
Well, I think I probably won't have an experience just exactly like this one, but I feel very optimistic about all of the surprises life offers. I mean, this whole thing, just finding his story was a huge surprise. And then all that I found out while I was working on it, every day was kind of wondrous and magical to me, because there was so much I could learn and find out, and I could go into this whole other world and inhabit it. And I know that there are other stories out there that I can do that with. And, you know, I will never have a low expectation of what life can offer, especially after watching what Louis went through and the grand life he ended up having, even in spite of everything he went through.
Well, Laura, it's been a fascinating conversation. I so appreciate talking to you and you taking the time. It was inspirational listening about Louis, and it was inspirational listening to your own story. And I really appreciate you taking the time. When you write that new book, you'll have to come back and tell me about it.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a delight to talk to you.
This is Richard Hsu and Laura Hillenbrand.